Morning, Council. While you're getting ready, I'll call the next case and make a few announcements. Our second case on the calendar is A221785, Thomas versus State of Minnesota. You can have a seat whenever you're ready, Council. You all are familiar with our procedures. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd ask that you state your name. Let us know how we can reference you this morning. Identify your client before you begin speaking. And these matters are being recorded. That is the only recording that is permitted today. Whenever you're ready, Council, we are ready for you.
Good morning. My name is Leah Graff, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Walter Thomas. Thomas was charged in Benton County District Court with multiple offenses involving multiple parties. After a jury trial wherein he asserted self-defense, Thomas was found guilty of second-degree assault, threats of violence, and domestic assault by strangulation. These verdicts were rendered in the wake of the District Court's erroneous admission of the prior out-of-court statements of the only alleged victim to testify at the trial. Those statements included numerous hearsay accusations, as well as highly prejudicial character evidence. The verdicts also came following the district court's plainly erroneous admission of evidence that Thomas had prior police contacts. Thomas asked this court, in the first instance, to reverse his convictions and remand the case for a new trial. In the alternative, Thomas asked this court to reverse and remand for resentencing based on a corrected criminal history score of 0. On remand during a stay of this direct appeal, the state failed to meet its burden to prove by a fair preponderance of the evidence that a out-of-state, Indiana in particular, strangulation offense could be included in Thomas's criminal history score as a felony. I'd like to begin with a focus on the erroneous admission of the complaining witness MC's prior statement.
Can we just talk about what happened? I mean, the transcript, and I've reviewed her statement, I've listened to her statement, I've reviewed the trial transcript of her testimony. It's the way that the statement came in is a little, and what the precise objection was to the statement is confusing to me. It appears, well, let's start with this. It appears that the statement was not admitted until after MC had testified, correct?
Correct.
And there was a redaction of information about, or some statements about the use of a gun, right?
That is correct. There was some discussion about that in light of a limited amount of 63420 evidence that the court permitted her to testify about. So they did ensure that those two pieces matched, but that was it.
And it's my understanding that trial counsel cross-examined MC on the witness stand during the trial with the statement to impeach her credibility.
Yes, that is accurate.
That open the door to the admission of the statement?
So counsel was free to cross-examine her and impeach her with the out-of-court statement, but that doesn't mean that it was admitted as substantive evidence.
And so the question that I have then is, isn't really the complaint one of potentially ineffective assistance of counsel for failing to ask for a limiting an instruction to the jury that the evidence was submitted not for the truth of the matter asserted, but instead for impeachment purposes?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because what happens next is crucial, and that is that the state wants to and is successful in getting the evidence in as substantive evidence. And so counsel's request to limit its use would be rejected based on the district court's ruling that it was admissible substantively as a prior consistent statement.
So let me ask it a different way. Why isn't it a matter of trial strategy for Mr. Thomas's trial counsel to say, actually, there's inconsistencies between MC's trial testimony and what's in her statement, which I think you agree with on appeal, And so I'm not going to object to the introduction of this statement because I'm going to use it, as I did in cross-examination, to highlight that MC is not a credible witness. And so as a matter of trial strategy, I don't want a limiting instruction. I just want the whole thing in.
I suppose that could be an approach, but that again, that's not what happened on the record. So counsel, again, was free to use the statement as he did on cross-examination for impeachment. That doesn't amount to a concession that it's admissible as substantive evidence, which the state ultimately did, and that is the ruling that is before this court.
Why
not
can't
a question about trial strategy in the context of an ineffective assistance claim.
Why can't we infer that it was a matter of trial strategy? Because when I look at the transcript after MC testified, after the gun information is redacted from the statement, it doesn't appear to me that there's any specific objection to any particular statement that MC made that is part of the thing that is admitted. So it doesn't look to me like trial counsel is all up in arms that something's coming in that absolutely is prejudicial to the case.
I'm going to push back in two ways on that point. And the first is that counsel's trial strategy isn't relevant to the claim on appeal. The claim isn't one of ineffective assistance of counsel. So a question of strategy doesn't resolve the issue, which is, did the district court abuse its discretion in deciding that the statement could come in substantively under 801 D1B or 807? So that is the focus. And the other reason is that I don't think that the, you know, mid-trial evidentiary arguments can be choppy, but I think reading counsel's statement in full throughout the course of this discussion of MC's prior statement coming in, it starts with the prosecutor saying, I know there are hearsay objections. The state makes a specific argument that the evidence comes in substantively as prior consistent or inconsistent statements. Our position is it's wrong about that. The district court was wrong about that. Counsel repeats, I don't think they've been clear enough about how they're going to get this evidence in, both the prior consistent and inconsistent statements. That's a hearsay problem. Everybody understands it's a hearsay problem because that's how the state argued it. That's how the court ruled. And counsel did bring up prejudice and cumulativeness and also the inconsistency in the statement. So I think we have to set aside the question of trial strategy, look at how everybody understood the issue in the district court, and then review the ruling on that basis.
I'm not sure that the statements were inconsistent.
And so,
I think there's some additions. I think of an inconsistent statement as something like he was wearing red or he was wearing blue or whatever. You know, that's an inconsistent statement.
Certainly. And the argument in Rule 801, as it relates to prior consistent statements, precludes two things. That is inconsistent statements, and this court has been very clear. It also precludes additional statements that are about events that were not the subject.
Thank you, because I think what you're arguing is there are additional statements,
yes,
not that they're inconsistent.
That statements. Is absolutely correct, Your Honor. And the comments to the rule have addressed this very topic for decades at this point, talking about we don't allow the bootstrapping of inconsistent or additional statements.
And is it fair to characterize the additional statements that Thomas is complaining about on appeal are the 8 statements that are set forth in your brief?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes, those are the specific ones that
we have. So then my question to you is, so he's convicted and sentenced on the assault too. And it looks to me like the statements that, you know, speaking for myself and not for my colleagues, that appear to be for sure in addition to her testimony at trial is that she was the only one taking care of the kids with no help. He had tried to receive mental health help before, that she was trying to break the cycle with her daughter, and she was unsure if he was using illicit substances, but he had used them before and been around her. Tell me why those statements had a significant effect on the verdict. It's not clear to me how those statements impacted the verdict. And assuming they were erroneously admitted.
Certainly. And I think I just want to emphasize that we've identified a specific prior threat as an additional statement that that he was texting her, threatening to kill her the week before the offense, and also a specific right. instance in which she called police subject to her testimony. And getting to the prejudice piece of the puzzle, though, I think that it's important to focus on the fact that this was a self-defense case. We have a victim who could not testify to any sequence of events, who could not recall or describe to the jury what was happening, what Mr. Thomas was saying in any lead up to any particular allegation of violence on his part. Those facts are crucial for the jury in deciding the viability of his self-defense claim.
She did admit she stabbed him with a pen.
Correct. She begrudgingly says, I probably stabbed him with a pen. I probably burnt him with a cigarette. I don't think that cuts against a prejudice argument. I think that supports it here, is that this was a case where we have a victim who can't describe the sequence of events and admits to physical contact directed toward the defendant. She even said, as to the cigarette burn, I probably did that because he was bothering me. Before anybody was in fight mode, I probably burned him with a cigarette. I also think it's important to note that the state on rebuttal said, you heard his statement, you saw her testify, and you heard her statement, and then argued to the jury, decide who's credible on the issue of self-defense, on guilt and self-defense. So the state calls it out in rebuttal. The jury also asked to listen to the statements again during the course of their deliberations. The district court ultimately said, I'm not going to do that. That's half the evidence. We're not going to do that again. But I think, again, it emphasizes the point that this was something that the jury was focused on during deliberations. So I think that... And maybe Your Honor's question is getting at this question about split verdicts and things, but I think that Portillo really steers us away from relying too much or speculating too much on split verdicts outside of maybe when all other factors support a finding of prejudice and the split verdicts don't have independent, Portillo says they don't have independent significance in the prejudice analysis. So I think looking at this trial as a whole, the nature of the dispute here, which was about who started it and who did what when, with a victim who couldn't really answer that question, that these types of statements that sort of sway the jury, and remember, they come in not subject to the court's limiting instruction on relationship evidence. That instruction is limited to a specific incident. So all of this comes before the jury with the full force of its character inferences still attached. So if the jury thought, boy, sounds like he's been a bad guy before, he was probably the bad guy here. That's precisely the problem with what happened and why we believe it was prejudicial.
So if we, go along with your argument and we're weighing the impact, can we balance these admissions she made about, I broke a hanger on him, I burned him with a cigarette. I mean, can we weigh that in saying, wait a minute, on balance, maybe this hurt her more than those statements hurt her credibility, more than it helped him or helped his side of the case. I'm a little inartful there, but you get my drift.
I do, Your Honor. And I think that's... The statements about the cigarette and the stabbing him with a pen come in her testimony. So they're in either way. The question is, this is an impact analysis of how could this, is it reasonably likely that a jury relied on this type of evidence when the state asked it to and when there was a self-defense claim? Was it reasonable for the jury to consider whether they had called the police on him before, whether the kids had been exposed to violence on previous occasions, whether he sent texts the week before being in a threatening way, whether he was a helpful dad or not? Is it reasonable reasonably likely that the jury would have relied on that in deciding who's credible and who and whether he has a viable claim of self-defense. And our position is absolutely. That's exactly the type of information a jury is going to consider. They weren't limited in their ability to consider it. And they asked to listen to the statement again during deliberation. So with that in mind, I don't think speculating about the extent to which the statement hurt her really answers the question in an impact analysis. And I think that, the hearsay error is this most straightforward way for this court to address the problem and requires a reversal and remand for a new trial without any need to deal with plain error or engage with the fourth prong of that analysis. We would ask the court to do so in this case, given the errors in the district court's analysis and the prejudicial nature of the many accusations in the statement that should not have been before the jury. And if the court doesn't have any questions right now, I will see you on rebuttal.
All right, thank you very much, Ms. Graff.
Thank you.
You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Lidia Villalba-Lijo, and I represent the respondent state of Minnesota. I'm an assistant attorney general. I'd like to focus on the issues related to the admission of MC's statement at trial. And in considering MC's statement, the context is highly important. These charged crimes arose from a day-long chaotic incident of domestic violence that involved appellant, MC, and their children. MC and appellant were involved in or had been in an 18-year relationship that had deteriorated and now was coming to an end. MC and appellant were both injured that day, June 8, 2021. Appellant claimed that he acted in self-defense and that MC was the aggressor. And finally, another important context to consider is that more than 1 year before trial, the state noticed its intention to admit Section 634.20 relationship evidence, and that notice can be found at index number 16. So just to begin with the prior consistent statement, the trial court did not abuse its discretion in admitting MC's statement as a prior consistent statement. The trial judge made clear that it reviewed the transcript of MC's statement, that it listened to MC's in-court testimony, and it also had the benefit and listened to the party's arguments about the statement. The judge determined that the statement and the trial testimony were consistent and further said it would be helpful to the trier of fact to be able to review and hear that statement and compare that to her testimony. Now, the admission of MC's statement did not significantly affect the verdict. A, it was presented in a straightforward and direct manner during the testimony of Officer Simondet.
Is it your position that the entirety of MC's statement is admissible as a prior consistent statement?
It's our position that
one of the allegations is that she made was that he had tried to receive assistance previously for mental health services, that she was unsure if he was using drugs that day, but that he had previously come around and used drugs. That wasn't in her trial testimony.
That's correct, Your Honor, and you've highlighted the two points that are outside of what could be described as consistent. However, on the point of the mental illness issue, it was raised in the context of MC saying that she had tried to obtain help for him and hadn't been successful in doing that. And so it was a very, it was a brief statement. She didn't dwell on it.
So how are those statements admissible? I mean, they're not prior consistent statements, so what's the basis for their admissibility?
Well, the basis for the admissibility, and it's something that I also am planning to discuss today, is the issue of the relationship evidence. I thought it would be helpful to focus first on the prior consistent statement aspect and then move to the character or relationship evidence.
She could testify about that on the stand, but the issue is that this is an out-of-court statement.
Yes.
So can you reconcile those two then? I mean, it may be relationship evidence, but if it's beyond what she testified to in court, I think that's part of the issue.
I think it is part of the issue. What I would say about the mental health statement is that it was a very brief reference to that. With regard to the use of drugs, there is a fair amount of testimony at trial that Mr. Thomas appeared that day intoxicated, but there's also testimony by the officers that he didn't appear all that intoxicated. During Mr. Thomas's statement to police, when he's having a conversation with Officer Nowinski, he points out, you know, I'm not really that drunk, and the officer says, well, you don't seem that drunk to me. You seem to be walking okay, and you seem okay. There's testimony there's testimony about him having an odor of alcohol, and certainly MC testifies to that.
I mean, the concerning piece of it is that now we have a hearsay statement, a statement that was made out of court,
right,
that is ostensibly going to reconcile these inconsistencies, and there was no limiting instruction from the district court to say, take these statements that are made out of court, not for the truth of the matter asserted, but to provide context to the party's relationship. So how do we deal with that potential error?
Well, there was, when the court gave a limiting instruction, the court gave a limiting instruction before the 634-20 evidence was, before the statement was admitted, and again during final instruction. And that instruction, it is true that instruction is more focused on the 2000 and I believe it's 2008 choking incident. However, that instruction does include the statement that let me find that. It also is broader than that because it includes a statement. I'll remind you, the defendant is not being tried for and may not be convicted of any behavior other than the charged offenses. So it's broader than just the 2008 choking incident. But I think the state acknowledging that the statement about the mental health concern and the statement about drug use should not have come in or may have been error as part of the admission, I think we can focus on what was the harm. Where was the harm in admitting the overall statement? And so I would like to address that because I think that is really very important here. I had started to discuss the admission of MC's statement not significantly affecting the verdict because the way that it was presented in a direct manner, there was nothing. It was presented in a direct and straightforward manner. The evidence was not necessarily, the statement overall was not necessarily highly persuasive because it demonstrated the prior statement demonstrated the same difficulty that MC had at trial, which was difficulty in presenting a chronology of events. The prosecutor did refer to MC's testimony and statement in closing, but she didn't single out the recorded statements, bless you, or urge reliance only on those prior statements. But importantly, and I think this Judge Frisch, this gets to something that you brought up earlier, I think it's very important here to consider that this was a self-defense case, and the defense counsel was very effective in countering the evidence in two different ways. During the cross-examination of Officer Simondet, defense counsel established that MC had answered, "I don't know," to a number of the officer's questions. That's found on transcript page numbers 370 to 373. Defense counsel also used the information in the statement as a way to highlight that police failed to collect information at the scene. For instance, the clothing that MC had worn when the alcohol was opened by in her face or near her, and the clothing she was wearing when she was cut by the knife, or to collect the bottle that was used to hit MC. Now, in closing, defense counsel, I think it could be said, went to town. He argued that MC's multiple "I don't know" answers demonstrated her lack of credibility. He also called specific attention to the 2008 choking incident that had been admitted. And he used MC's clear memory of that to contrast with her sketchy memory at trial about this incident. So defense counsel was able to use MC's statement to help establish the defense theory of the case, that MC was not a reliable or a credible witness, that she was the aggressor, and that appellant acted in self-defense, and also that police failed to vigorously investigate this case. Then, of course, there's also appellant's own statements that came in, which provided jurors with his version of events, that MC could not accept the end of the relationship and attacked him. I'm starting to run out of time, so I'm just going to jump into the what I call the character relationship evidence. The statements that were identified by appellant as impermissible character evidence is relationship evidence that helps explain the strained relationship between the parties here and would be helpful to providing jurors with context of what occurred. But it also appears from the record very clearly that the defense strategy involved highlighting the nature of this deteriorating relationship. And here are some examples. Before the statement was even admitted, defense counsel began his opening with the statement that MC allegedly made while appellant was being tased. And that statement that she allegedly made was, "I hope they kill your ass." He also told jurors that it was the penultimate ending of that relationship, that date, the events on that date were the penultimate ending of that relationship. And this is the end of a relationship gone horribly wrong where everyone received injuries. Counsel began his closing argument with the same statement that MC had made and added, "You don't see that in the course of someone you love." That's on page, transcript page 513. He also discussed the injuries that were inflicted by MC against appellant, including the cigarette burn, which he pointed out demonstrated her hatred. Pointed out appellant's statements to police about feeling surrounded, being surrounded by the kids and feeling smothered, and MC being on top of him. Again, referred to the 2008 choking incident to highlight MC's poor memory. And then, of course, again, we have appellant's own statements to police where he's asserting that he was the victim here. So the character and the relationship evidence in this statement, it fit in and it supported the defense strategy at trial. So there were two strategies. One was to highlight the chaotic nature of this relationship. And so information in that statement actually may have assisted likely did assist defense counsel in making those arguments. And I don't have the cite to the transcript ready, but the trial judge, during closing arguments, does point out to defense counsel that statement had some statements that were beneficial to you and also beneficial to the state. So, again, this statement was beneficial in two ways. It allowed defense counsel to argue that MC lacked credibility. She was she couldn't testify in a clear manner. She couldn't provide details. She couldn't explain when things happened. And also that this was a chaotic relationship. And she had motive as part of that relationship to that this was part of a chaotic, destructive relationship in which she had harmed him. She stabbed him. She burned him with a cigarette. Judge Riley, you look like you have a question.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Now, there's other evidence. So the statement, what the state is arguing here is that this statement that came in, first of all, it was not an abuse of the court's discretion. It was largely consistent with her prior statement, with the exceptions that have been discussed. But those exceptions, really, they're not further developed at trial. And, in fact, it may have benefited defense, given the defense strategy of self-defense and that it was MC who was the attacker. So the state would ask this court to please affirm. If there's any, I've got about a second left.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Graff, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I want to start by jumping back into the limiting instruction that respondent argues went beyond this 2008 relationship evidence issue. Respondent noted a part of the instruction. It's on page 5 of the jury instructions. Defendant is not being tried for and may not be convicted of any behavior other than the charged offenses. The very next sentence is, you are not to convict the defendant on the basis of similar conduct on Megan Lorraine Carter in 2008. So the instruction on relationship evidence starts with reference to the 2008 incident and ends with reference to the 2008 incident. So I don't think there's any reasonable argument that the jury was somehow to understand that instruction to apply to other evidence that was not identified within the instruction, both at the time it was given, during the trial, and in the closing instructions. I also want to just clarify the relationship between relationship evidence and hearsay. And there were some questions sort of hovering around that topic. And before the jury could use any evidence to shed light on the nature of the relationship, that evidence had to be admissible for the truth. And so I think that it's important to keep these on separate tracks in terms of where the error lies and whether resolution of one error in one direction actually answers the question on the other. So even if this court were to conclude that this was admissible relationship evidence, which we don't agree with for the reasons particularly addressed in the reply, that doesn't answer the hearsay question, and that is still an error that this court must address. I also want to address the prejudice issue as respondent presented it today, which is that the admission of MC's prior recorded statement somehow was trial strategy and really allowed defense counsel to make the arguments that he made in closing. And that's simply not consistent with the record. So defense counsel did not highlight in the self-defense case the challenged portions of MC's statement. He did not argue to the jury that because he had the police called on him in Gary, Indiana previously, he must not have been the aggressor here. That wouldn't make sense. It wasn't an argument that was put forth. Also, To the extent counsel argued that MC wasn't credible because of I don't know answers, that all happened in front of the jury. To the extent defense counsel argued that the police investigation was poorly done and they failed to follow up on various leads, was evidence that counsel elicited on cross-examination of those officers. You didn't do this. You didn't look for this. You didn't take a photo of that. So those arguments in closing don't really answer the question of how the statement was used, because they really aren't about the statement. They're about other evidence that was elicited at trial. And if the statement wasn't highly persuasive, then the state wouldn't have called it out in closing on rebuttal. And the state did separately refer to her testimony and her statement. So again, we have the state highlighting it for a reason, and the jury was clearly paying attention as they asked to listen to it again. And I know that the focus of respondents' argument was the reference to mental health help and drug use, but again, there are other prior incidents that were not the subject of her testimony. It's not sufficient under the rule that she talked about threatening conduct on one day or comments related to sex on one day, and therefore anything he's ever said or any threatening conduct he's ever engaged in comes in. It's simply not what the rule permits. It is a narrow basis for admission, and this court should maintain that in this case. For the reasons we've argued, we'd ask for reversal and remand for a new trial, in the alternative, a remand for resentencing in light of the district court's error on the criminal history score.
Any other questions? Thank you very much,
Thank
counsel.
You.
Thank you very much for your submissions. Counsel's very helpful to the court. The matter is submitted. We will issue an opinion within the statutory time period.